Play fake. Beathard sets up deep in the pocket. Goes down the field for Smith. Ah, he got it! Smith! Touchdown, 85 yards, Iowa!
56-yarder. It's got, no, does not have the leg. And Chris Davis takes it to the back of the end zone. He'll run it out to the 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, 45,
50, 45.
There goes Davis.
Oh, my God.
Davis is going to run it all the way back. Auburn's going to win the football game.
Don't miss a thing from the world of college football. Stay right here for College Gridiron on WFUV Sports.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, what a season that was. 2024 regular season in the books. We've got a big postseason about to embark on. Rivalry, pretty dramatic, no? I'd say so. And I think that conference realignment kind of contributed to a lot of that. And, well, we do have a show for y'all today. And we, I mean, Thomas Tisdale, Barrett Spreitzer, I'm Isabella Terracini, and Bradley Byrne is behind the board. And lads, I do have a genuine question for you. How do you think, based on the regular season, was realignment good for the NCAA?
Yes. A tentative yes. I think competitive-wise, overall season, you know, every game mattering, you can attribute that to the 12-team playoff, you can attribute that to realignment. I mean, there was a part in there where, like, early in the season, like, first 5 weeks, where Cal was, like, a legitimate, like, have to watch because of they played some really good games against some really good teams that they wouldn't have played otherwise. The Big 12 this year, I think, is a great testament to realignment and what it could do, and that you saw, you know, Arizona State had a great year, but then there were some, you know, Utah and Arizona teams that were really good in the Pac-12, didn't do so great in the Big 12. Really competitive in the Big 12 this year, so that's a testament to realignment. I think, though, in the Big 10, I think you could argue was a complete testament against what realignment has done. USC, UCLA, just both teams looked like they didn't really have any business in the Big 12. It was, and, you know, you can attribute that to whatever, but I think a lot of it is style of play, right? The Pac-12, just like the Big 12 did in the mid-2010s, that, you know, these conferences develop a style of play, and it doesn't change overnight. And so when you go into these new conferences in the Big 10, which, I mean, still wasn't super competitive, you had three teams, just like it's been for the last 10, 15 years, whatever. In the SEC, you had Texas, but, you know, Texas was in the playoff last year, so does SEC realignment really mean anything? I think in the Big 12 was really the only real testament to it's a better conference now than it was last year, and it's the only one I think you can definitively say this conference got better and it's more entertaining, even though it lost OU and UT. I still think the Big 12 was more competitive, it was better, more fun to watch even than it was last year, and I think it. So I won't say the other conferences were worse because of realignment, other than the Pac-12, the Pac-2. I don't know. Both those teams, just you can kind of ignore them, fell off a cliff. But I won't say any of the other conferences got worse. So I will say that because the Big 12 got better, in my eyes, I will say that the conference realignment was a good thing for the NCAA this year.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, we can debate whether conferences got better or like more exciting, but you have to agree that this regular season was probably the most exciting that we've had in recent memory. And just we just get incredible matchups, like, you know, Penn State and USC. Like, that matchup would happen like maybe every 15 years. I mean, we got Texas versus Texas A&M this past weekend, and I think we'll talk about that. But like, we just get so many exciting matchups, and then also the parity between the teams across the conferences, I thought, was a little bit more even. I mean, we talk about the SEC. I mean, besides Texas and maybe Georgia, I mean, just so many games where either team could win, and, you know, Vanderbilt got better, Oklahoma got better. There are a lot of notable instances where the games were way more competitive. Part of that's because of NIL, I think. And then just the Big 12, like, Barrett was talking about is so much better this year. I mean, it was like a four-way race at the very end to see who can make the Big 12 championship. And so just based on that alone, I think you have to say realignment's better. And just getting more exciting matchups, I think, is overall better for the sport.
And can I touch on that parity real quick, too? Yeah. And I think that's a testament to really all of the changes we've seen with NIL, with conference realignment, and with the 12-team playoff. And that, I mean, whether you think it should happen or not, there's legitimate conversation for a three-loss team to make the playoff because they think they're good enough to be in the playoff and to compete for a national championship. And that's, and on top of that, you saw early National Signing Day was yesterday. The number one class in the country this year would be the number five class in the country. For every the highest it would ever be was the number five class in the country since recruiting rankings were tracked, basically meaning that the number one class in this year, like, it's, there's such a smaller gap between, you know, the top of the country and everyone else in recruiting, and that's a great testament to conference realignment, right? These schools, like Cal, can now say, hey, we play in the ACC. You know, it's, we play Clemson, we play Miami, we play, you know, all these ACC schools,
East Coast schools,
yeah. All the, and we're in, and now they can go and recruit from that, you know, they can go and recruit from Florida, they can go and recruit from North Carolina, and they can go and recruit from these places because, hey, we're going to play them, right? And so that's, I think that's also a testament to where realignment has helped in that recruiting, right? Texas now, you know, Texas always had Texas, but now they can go and recruit from the SEC as well. They're not just recruiting Big 12 country, they're recruiting SEC country as well, and that'll help Texas. It'll trickle down to A&M, right? And it'll be, hey, you know, these Texas kids that wanted to play, you know, the Baylors and, you know, feel like that the play the kids that they grew up, play, you know, all of this rivalry that they've had. It's now, that rivalry is still there. It's not just, hey, you know, Texas and Texas A&M, they know each other exists, but you'll never see it. There's a legitimate reason to push that as a recruiting pitch is like, hey,
do you want to play
our rivals
on one of the biggest stages in America? I think that game got over 9 million viewers.
9.5, I believe.
Yeah. I mean, we could honestly just jump right into that game. I know this is not going to be your most favorite topic of
conversation. Yeah, I've had a miserable week.
No,
let's just say that.
No, but you know what?
I haven't had a good, you know, I haven't woken up happy since Saturday. Okay? I haven't woken up happy since Saturday.
But it's just got to be debriefed at some point. So, if you're missing a puzzle piece here, Texas did beat Texas A&M 17-7 for the first Lone Star Showdown since 2011. And some food for thought, the last time that Texas A&M was zero at half was in 2017. And this was the longest Aggie pick six since 1992.
All the good it did them.
Yeah. But you know what? It got Kyle Field loud again. I mean,
it was really loud.
I loved. Yeah, you were there.
It was really loud. It was fun.
Tell us about that experience watching it in person.
I wish I hadn't been there. I'm going to be honest. It was depressing. It was
the
sad walk out of
the
stadium.
The pregame, I remember watching it, and it was like,
I was so loud. It was so fun.
Did you have one of those towels?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so sick.
We had our towels. We sung the war hymn like three times before the game even started.
And it was like,
it was so awesome.
It was like,
and then the game started
on ABC for some reason.
And then the game started, and it's like A&M had never called an offensive play before, right? You can say what you want about the defensive play calling, that the defense has been not great for the last couple weeks. But, you know, they gave up, I think, 450 yards or something.
Mm-hmm.
But they held them to seven. They held UT, one of the best offenses in the country, to 17 points. There's no excuse on the offensive side to not score. You didn't score a single point. First drive of the game, you go for it on fourth instead of kicking the field goal. What are we doing? You take the points there.
I think that was just
last drive of the game.
I think that four on fourth was just to get the excited.
But if you kick both of those field goals, you're 17-13. You got to get a stop anyways with, like, I think it was like 2.5 minutes left in the game. If you kick both those field goals instead of going for it on fourth, regardless of the play call, which we can get into being maybe the worst offensive play call in the last 15 years in football, period, not just college football. I mean, absolutely horrendous play call. Just especially out of a timeout to come out with that play call after just running that exact play the play before. Well, I mean, okay, we don't. I'm not going to talk about the play call. It is what it is. Obviously, they thought they saw something, but I will talk about the decision to go for it. In that, if you kick it and you kick it on the fourth down on the first drive of the game, you're 17-13 with like I think it was like 2 minutes and 15 seconds left or something. Even if you had scored the touchdown there, your defense has to go get and get another stop. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, in my opinion, to then... Okay, so if you go for it on the first fourth down of the game, or if you kick the field goal, you're getting points early. Ignoring that one, you're then on the last offensive play of the game. You kick it, you're 17-10, you have to get a stop. You get it and you score, you're 17-14, and you have to get a stop. I personally have a lot more faith in a fourth down do or die versus a, like, there's time left, we got to play defense, just stupid. I have a lot of feelings about the play calling, about the coaches who I haven't really, even a week later, haven't been able to put it all, you know, together. I just, something about that A&M team fell apart down the stretch.
Yeah,
I don't know what it was.
But then it came back alive in the third.
For
a little bit.
You can't even say it came back alive in the
because
third.
Because it was a defensive touchdown. None of the offensive players
the offense didn't do anything. There was nothing that happened on offense.
It was
there was a really defensively powered game. There was one play in the game where Kyle Field got into the game, and that was on the pick six.
Right.
And then it's immediately over because it's a pick six. It's not like it's a long, sustained drive. So the offense gave the fans
shout
of Kyle Field absolutely no reason to get into the game. Just, I mean, the offensive play calling was pitiful. Defensively, they held them to 17, but they gave like 450 yards. Just congrats to Texas, but the last 3.5, 4 weeks of the season were just ugly, ugly games on A&M's part. And all you had to do was beat South Carolina and you're in the SEC championship game is how it would have worked out. Instead, you go down 21-7 against South Carolina. Then you go down 21-0 against Auburn. And then you go down 17-0 against Texas. And it was 17-0 at one point, though.
Yeah.
Or I think so.
Until half.
And it was just changes need to be made, and it's. I know we said we were gonna do this quickly, but this is why I didn't want to talk about it.
These are his grievances. You have to give him the air and the space to talk about this. Just let him cook. Continue.
For that to be the offensive output in the first Lone Star Showdown in
13
years is unjustifiable. I know there are Aggie fans who are calling for Elko's head. I think that is a horrendous take. However, I think Colin Klein needs to be gone. I think Bateman needs to be gone. I think both coordinators need to go. The defense couldn't make adjustments all year. They would come back and out of the half, make great adjustments, and then fourth quarters looked pitiful almost all year. The offensive play calling was just, it was stagnant. It was dull. There weren't a whole lot of changes that were made ever. I think they both need to go. But, again, UT did what they needed to.
Three stops on fourth downs.
Fourth downs. The defensive line did enough to allow that defensive secondary, the defensive backfield, to do what they do, which is just elite, an elite passing defense that UT has, a good enough rush defense.
Yeah, 186 yards was Wisner's career high.
Yeah, Wisner went crazy. Gunnar Helm went crazy.
Yeah.
There are some concerns about Texas in that they only scored 17. The end product needs to be better, right? You can get 450 yards, but you got to put the ball in the end zone.
Yeah.
You can't be throwing red zone pick sixes. You can't be fumbling the ball in the red zone. There are some questions about UT, but a hard-fought rivalry game. I feel like UT's got a lot of momentum, especially going into this SEC championship game. We're talking about Texas is going in with all the momentum. Georgia have won a very late 8 overtime thriller against Georgia Tech that they really didn't have any business winning. I think Georgia Tech should have won that.
Absolutely.
Georgia Tech probably should have won it in regulation, but I think everyone listening to this is now sick of hearing me talk about anything, so I'll pass it back to y'all.
I mean, I don't really have any more else to say, like, especially negative stuff. I mean, it was a blowout. You just look at the yards, like 458 yards to 248. Like, that's just a blowout. Texas, like, tried their best to sort of give the game back to Texas A&M and make it interesting, but for whatever reason, Texas A&M just could not get it going on the offensive end. I mean, we can talk about the play calls. We can talk about the decision to go for it on fourth down. I actually don't hate the decision to go for it on fourth down because they ended up getting the stop after they turned it over on down. So it's not like and you get the ball on the 1 yard line. I mean, like, considering how poorly the Texas A&M offense had been playing, like, you'd take that opportunity and you'd say, I like our odds to go score there because odds are they don't get another opportunity like that. I mean, you don't get to start your drives on the opposing 19-yard line every time. So I don't hate that decision, but just for whatever reason, they just could not get it going on the offensive end and then just could not run the ball, and Texas played a good enough game to get it done against a fairly poor Texas A&M team.
One thing I do want to shout out is the refs, 34 straight quarters without a holding call against Texas A&M opponents. Statistically improbable, bordering on impossible. I mean, the best defensive line in the country can't get a holding call. What are we doing? Come on, SEC officiating. You have a UT grad, UT alum, Austin business owner, is the replay official. SEC officiating. What are we doing? There was a couple of plays that went to replay that just were absolutely baffling
decisions.
Both
touchdowns.
There
was not one clear touchdown except for that pick six. Everything else had to be looked over.
There was the two touchdowns. I think both of them were touchdowns. I will agree.
Yeah.
There was then the targeting, not targeting. That was almost, I mean, just blatant targeting that didn't even get reviewed.
I feel like that happened in a lot of games this weekend.
Yesterday. It's hard to justify that. There's a UT alum who is a business owner in Austin, is the replay official. How is that allowed in a rivalry game?
Don't ask me.
And then on top of it, the refs can't throw a flag for holding. And then after the game, you see probably 15 to 30 screenshots of just blatant holding. And 34 quarters is insane. Do you know how many games that is?
I really don't want to do math right now. Come on.
It's 8.5 games. Right, 8.5 games without a holding call against A&M opponents. I had to do the math, too, so that's why there was a pause there. Yeah. But again, we said we weren't going to spend too much time on this game, so please, let's change the subject before I go on for another hour.
I just want to mention one more thing. Connor Wegman did enter the portal.
It's a sad day.
And that is the end of what we're going to talk about for Texas A&M. But do I want to talk about, I don't know, the game?
Let's talk about the game.
So, Michigan and OSU was a watch. It was quite a time where I sat on my couch and just watched the TV. But Dominic Zvada, Zvada was able to knock the 21-yard field goal in the last 45 seconds to get the Wolverines their fourth consecutive win over number 2 Ohio State. Final score 13-10. This was the largest underdog win since 1978. They were 20.5-point underdogs. They were tied at 10 going into the fourth, and the last time a tie going into the final 15 was in 1999. Two back-to-back interceptions, a missed field goal, and 1 yard was gained. All happened within 5 minutes in the third quarter. What a quarter. I sat there and watched, and I think we all did. 3 out of 4 interceptions were in the red zone. So I don't know if y'all want to bring that back to Texas A&M, but I think that's something else. That's completely different. But this was one of the best offenses that was only held to one touchdown in the second and a field goal with a total of 77 rushing yards. Crazy.
I mean, I've been saying it probably not even just all year. I've been saying it for a couple years now that Ryan Day is the biggest fraud in
he's out of a job in football.
I mean, there's not a whole lot to say. Jim Harbaugh said it best. Ryan Day was born on third base and thinks he hit a triple. Like, the guy hasn't done. He has the most talented wide receiver room in the country. He has the best wide receivers coach in the country. He has the most talented running back room in the country. He has five stars everywhere on the offensive line. What you think about Walker Howard, he is a five star. He personally chose him. He said, Kyle McCord, get out of here. I don't like you. Kyle McCord then led the nation in passing yards. Kyle McCord then went and
defeated
beat Miami.
Miami.
Kyle McCord then had a very good season, had Syracuse at 9-3, and Syracuse's best season in years.
Yeah.
And he said, I don't want you. Get out of here. You suck. You're a bum. Let me bring in my own quarterback. Defensively, I mean, he went and bought the best player in the transfer portal in Caleb Downs, who I think is the best player in the country, period, flat out, no matter what position he plays. You have then one of the best linebackers in the country in Jack Sawyer. You have just elite players all over the field. You have the quarterback that you handpicked out of the portal, and you can't score more than 10 points against the worst Michigan team in probably the last 6 years. You have not beaten Michigan. I think you beat Michigan in 2020, I think, was when they beat them.
Yeah,
last time
they
beat them.
Yeah, this was their fourth consecutive
year. You're 1-4, or maybe 2-4, against Michigan in your head coaching career. You can't beat top five teams. Like, you have... What do you do, Ryan Day, that justifies you still being the head coach of Ohio State? What do you do that justifies you still being allowed to manage one of the historic programs? What do you do that allows you to be associated with one of the historic programs in college football, to be put on a pedestal as one of the best coaches purely because you coach Ohio State? You have no business being a Power 5 coach, and you can't even beat, you can't beat your rival one time when they are as down as could possibly be on a first-year head coach. They don't even have a quarterback, and you can't score more than 10 points. You run the ball up the middle 15 times in a row, and you can't get a single yard. You don't decide to change the plan at all. After the game, your team's fighting, and you're standing there staring up into the clouds. You're one of the just faces of Ohio State football, one of the absolute pillars of what it means to be an Ohio State football player, and Jack Sawyer is fighting for the logo. He's trying to defend the honor of Ohio State, and you're just standing there looking around lost. Like, go be a leader, man. Go be a leader. Go say something. Go do something. Inspire your team. Do something other than just stand there and look lost, and then go on TV and talk about Jim Harbaugh. Go on TV and talk about Lee Corso. Go on TV and say, hey, I want to be Urban Meyer, and then do nothing to be Urban Meyer. It's just absolutely embarrassing for what he's, like, where Ohio State should be based off of history and off of talent versus where they are because of him as the coach. And I think if you put there's probably 40 to 50 coaches in the nation that could win probably more. There's definitely a couple, you know, lower level FCS, D3, D2 coaches that could go win a national title with this Ohio State team. And for him to be limping into the playoff, for him to be unable to beat this Michigan team, it's embarrassing. Embarrassing is probably the only word that can even come close to describing what Ryan Day is as a representation of Ohio State.
I think he's a really talented head coach, just not when it comes to playing Michigan for whatever reason. Like, Michigan, for whatever, like, just, like, steps up their game, their defense. Like, I mean, Michigan has just played horrifically this entire season. But for whatever reason, when they travel to Columbus, they just
can't
go
get
to
it done.
Yeah, they just go to a whole nother level, and they just find a way to get it done. But the thing is, like, we can criticize Ryan Day for not beating Michigan, but the thing is Ohio State is going to be in the playoffs and Michigan is not. And so Ohio State is likely going to host a playoff game. I don't think they should, but that's neither here nor there. But Ohio State has an opportunity. They're not playing Michigan in the playoffs, so I don't see a reason why one of the most talented offenses in the country can't go out there and win a national championship.
I'll tell you, he's 3-6 against top five teams in his career. He's 1-3 in the playoffs. He's won one college football playoff game in his 5 years there.
That's fine.
2019?
Oh.
No. That's when they lost. 2020 in the COVID season, so it doesn't even count.
Yeah.
That doesn't even count.
When
they played six games and snuck into the college football playoff, and they beat Clemson, and he wants to... Yeah, I just...
I see where both of y'all are coming from, and I do see where you're putting your foot down and being like, this guy, he's... We could call him a fraud. Like, we could. And I do think that this was his last year as head coach at Ohio State, probably in the NCAA, just based on the reaction from his own players fighting. That did get way too out of hand. I mean, for the police to get involved with pepper spray. And it kind of started this domino effect through the rest of, not even just the Saturday, but into the weekend, like into Sunday, NFL teams were throwing fists. It's been a really wild and like crazy, like, I don't know, maybe like emotional weekend, but that was the game. Like, that was just a lot of, like, I feel like hyped up emotions and a lot of fights. And I don't know, I did really respect how Steve Sarkisian, like, led his team. He was like, do not go put the flag on the field. You're better than this. He, like, one player, like, did try to run out, and he just, like, grabbed him and, like, just threw him into the locker room. He was like, nope, this is not your business. Like, you need to respect. It was all over the place. But moving on, we've kind of touched on Syracuse-Miami. I mean, Syracuse defeated Miami, one of the best teams in the nation, arguably, 42-38. And Kyle McCord, like Barrett said, he was kicked out of, not kicked out, but yeah, Ryan Day basically kicked him out. Yeah, kicked him to the curb. He shined in this game, throwing for 380 yards and 3 touchdowns, becoming the first Syracuse player to surpass 4,000 passing yards in a season. So take that, Ryan Day. And now we can shift it to what everybody wants to hear. Week 15, conference champions. So to start us off, we have the Big 12 championship with number 18, Iowa State, and number 16, ASU, Arizona State University, at noon in Arlington. Now, I don't know if I like that setting for that matchup, but whatever. So both scored exactly 22 points versus Texas Tech. This is the very first time both of these two teams have ever met. So let's hear it.
Personally, I think ASU is going to win. I mean, Iowa State, they started extremely well, 7-0. And then just the defense just collapsed sort of in that 3-2 finish. And so, and ASU has one of the best running backs in the country. If it wasn't for
Cam.
Yeah, he's got
Cam
Scadabo. I mean, he's electric to watch.
He's been in the Heisman talking recently, believe it or not.
If there wasn't Travis Hunter, then I think there's a conversation to be had with him being up there. But obviously, I don't think you can give it to him. And then just ASU sort of just like not in the national media coverage like it should be, I think. So he's
being
just
hosed at 16. ASU should be a top 12 team. I don't know.
Over Ohio State, probably.
Nah, I think they're better than a lot of those. I think they're better. Maybe not better, but I think they're more deserving than all of the 3-loss SEC teams. Those guys, get them out of my sight.
I don't know what it is about 3-loss SEC teams and being in the playoffs.
SEC loves to play hypothetical games. And then, you know, like if Alabama and Arizona State played on a neutral site, Alabama would have been by 40. You know, well, they lost to Oklahoma by 21. So would they really? Probably not. You know, like Ohio State was 21-point favorites against Michigan, but then they played the game and they lost, right? You play the games for a reason. You lost some of your games.
For a reason.
Shut up and take it, right? Yeah. Like, but, you know.
If you don't want a flag planted on your field, how about you win a game?
Win the dang game.
It's not that hard. Just play better.
All right, but you were talking about the Big 12 championships.
Anyway, I mean, this is going to be a good game just based on how the Big 12 season has gone so far. You know, it's going to go back and forth, I think. But I just think ASU just has the edge just based on the running back Cam. And then I just don't think Iowa State has an answer for that. And then Iowa State's sort of just been limping towards the finish line, just trying to get into the Big 12 championship. So I just don't think they just can suddenly find that sort of the level of play that they started the season with.
going off of that, I do want to mention that this is the first time in school history that Iowa State has gotten 10 wins in a season. So they're kind of new at this whole...
Same for Indiana as well.
Yeah, but Indiana was the 66-point shutout versus Purdue. That was actually their largest conference shutout win in AP poll era.
All the stats from over there today.
Yeah. Well, got a big brain up here. So, but also Beck broke the school record for a touchdown pass in 16 straight games. ISU ranks 96th in rushing defense and 14th in Big 12, allowing 173 yards per game. I don't know how that's going to work out versus Cam Scadabo, but we'll just have to see. I just want to know if you think that the Cyclones will be able to stop one of the top 25 rush offenses.
I think the answer to that is blatantly no. I also want to point out that while Iowa State's defense has been kind of gotten worse every week, Arizona State's defense has kind of done the opposite. Recently, they've been playing very well. I think Kenny Dillingham is one of the best coaches in the country. He's easily a top 25 coach in my mind. I think what he's been able to do at Arizona State this year is incredible. But to answer your question, absolutely not. Iowa State will not be stopping Cam Scadabo. It's really just, can Arizona State's defense play as well as they've been playing the last, you know, 3 or 4 weeks? Look as fundamentally sound and just, you know, right? You know, it's a Big 12 defense. You know, they don't have, you know, the biggest, fastest, greatest athletes, but Dillingham's really, they play a very sound defense. They do what they need to. And when you have such a dominant rush offense, you know, your defense doesn't need to be on the field that much. So Arizona State's going to run the ball. If Iowa State can score when they get their opportunities, because it's going to be a very few possession game, because Arizona State's going to, they're going to try and really capitalize off that very poor rush defense that Iowa State has.
Yeah, if ASU jumps out to like a 7-0, like 14-0 lead, I think it's just game over at that point.
Well, I mean, they could also be lucky because the defense is so bad that Cam Scadabo could just break off a couple of 70-yard runs and then they get the ball right back.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But Cam Scadabo is 2 yards shy of his 1,400 rushing yard. And he ranks 8th in the NCAA for most rushing yards, obviously. I do really like this ASU defense. I do see that it's improved over the season. Being their first year in the Big 12, they've definitely made a statement. And I am excited to see what this game will bring about. Both of these teams are ranked in the top 100 in terms of recruiting class. ASU 45th, ISU 62nd for the class of 2025. And so we'll see if they get more of those really good key players. But we can just move right along to the SEC Championship. Number 2, Texas in Georgia, in Atlanta, versus number 5, the Bulldogs at 4 p.m. Central Time or Eastern?
Eastern Time.
And this is going to be a really big matchup. Ended in week 8, 30-15. Georgia just outplayed the Horns on the run, 108 yards to 29. Big yikes. But let's just talk about Carson Beck right now. He ranks 32nd for completion percentage when Ewers is sitting at number 16. Carson Beck is one of the most intercepted quarterbacks with 12. 3 of those were against Texas.
3 of them were against Alabama. He throws this in bunches.
He's looking, and I think he's looking 2 separate directions. Like, seriously, like, look at this guy's
eyes. He does have very
eyes.
Wide eyes. Yeah. Very wide set eyes.
Like, and really, like, deep eye bags, too. He's just
he's an ugly dude.
He's really scary looking. He's not very pretty to look at. Not when Arch Manning is standing right on the other side of the field. But I digress. So he admitted to not watching the Lone Star Showdown when he's playing either one of those teams in the final, in the championship game. So I don't know. Maybe there's no thoughts behind those eyes. Maybe it's just those eyes are really wide set. We'll never really know. This rush defense ranks 19th, allowing 105 yards per game, and the pass defense is 37th in the NCAA, allowing 196 yards per game. They're coming off that 8 overtime win, if you even want to call it that. Like, was it really a win, or was it like just kind of embarrassing?
They didn't deserve that at all.
Yeah. No, I don't. I don't know what else you could call it, but I don't care. But Beck did not throw an interception in that game. I don't know.
He did. Yeah, he did not.
No, he did not. I was about to say thank God, but no, I don't. Why? But they do need to toughen up their defense. When they're getting closer to the goal line, they're allowing 17 points in the red zone when Texas is only allowing 11. And I think that this game will be full of more penalties. They're both prone to big errors. I want to say that Texas has a better chance of keeping their composure, learning from the Georgia defeat in week 8. But I want to hear your thoughts.
I think that both of these teams are different teams than when they met last time. I think more so for Texas than Georgia. Georgia's a different team just because who knows what you're going to get with Carson Beck. Like, he's – what is he? Is he a good quarterback?
Alien?
Is he horrible?
I don't know.
Does he – who knows, right? Like, he was a guy that was a projected first-round pick, and now he's a projected day 3 undrafted guy because he –
to the Giants he goes.
Yeah, well, if he can play safe, right? He that second half in the whatever game it was, when he looks significant. No, yeah, second half against in the Alabama game when they made that comeback. After he threw all those picks in the first half, he came back in the second half and looked much better. He looked very good in that second half. And then that's a version of Carson Beck we've only seen maybe 5 more halves for the rest of the season. Like, he can't seem to put together a complete game. If Carson Beck's able to put together a complete game, I do like Georgia in this matchup. UT, I still don't see it. Like, the rush defense.
Okay.
No.
Okay, well. Fine.
I know you disagree with me. I know you disagree with me.
I think that's coming from a place of bias.
No. Statistically, the rush defense is not very good. The pass defense is very good. The defensive line is inconsistent, we'll say.
For Texas or Georgia?
For Texas.
Well, remember, Texas' total defense is 3rd nationally.
They are.
With a stop rate of 81%.
They have a... No.
Overall, their stop rate is impeccable.
UT's overall defense is elite.
But their rush, I hear.
Their rushing defense is not even close to the same level as their pass defense. And a large part of that is because of the inconsistency of their defensive line. They have the talent on the defensive line. Big fan of Colin Simmons, former 4-star from Austin Westlake. Big fan of him. I think he's very good, but he's young. And I think that's the same story with a lot of those defensive linemen. The older guys need to be better. The young guys need to be more consistent. The game is going to be won in the trenches. Georgia's offensive line has been not the Georgia's offensive line we've been used to seeing for the last couple of years. But I think this is a get-right game for that offensive line. If Carson Beck can put together a complete game, if Georgia's receivers can get any sort of separation, we could see a repeat. I do, however, want to acknowledge the fact that Arch Manning is now being incorporated in the offense in some specific packages where they're letting him use his legs. They're letting him throw the ball. And it's just a nice little wrinkle that they throw in. You know, he plays, 15 snaps in the game. I think he had 2 touchdowns against – or he had one of the touchdowns.
He had
the rushing touchdown. And he threw the touchdown, right?
No, he rushed the touchdown. Ewers threw the touchdown.
Ewers threw the touchdown. Okay. But Arch Manning looked very good in his. I think he played 15, maybe 20 snaps in that A&M game. It felt like every time they were in the red zone, Arch Manning was in. Made me really angry. But I think the wrinkles that UT is throwing in on offense, the improved defensive line. I'm not going to say great defensive line, but the improved consistency of the defensive line could prove challenging. But I think Georgia's going to come into this game with a lot of confidence. They went into Austin and put a beat down on UT.
But that was still when Ewers was still like recovering from his injury, from his early season injury. So I
yeah,
do
but
think
then
you're
still,
right. That
you've still seen Ewers make some bad decisions.
Yeah.
He threw that. Granted, it was tipped, but it was a bad decision to throw the ball on that pick six. The fumble, both of those were on Ewers. And I think there's a reason that Arch Manning is getting. And then Quinn Ewers also had the ankle thing where it was, is he going to play, is he not?
Yeah.
He looked fine. So, you know, maybe that was a little overblown.
I think so, but I think
but there's
that was,
also
that
a reason.
Was done, like,
there's also a reason that Arch Manning is getting these snaps now.
Yeah.
And it's because it feels like Quinn Ewers might be hurt. They might be a little not as confident on him. Georgia's seen him already, which, I mean, the thing about Quinn Ewers is he's. He does everything quite well, but he doesn't do anything, you know, extraordinary that you can't plan and prepare for. He's not a great runner. His arm doesn't jump off the page. He's not, you know, Lamar Jackson, Josh Allen, Pat Mahomes. He's more of a, you know, he's gonna make usually smart decisions. He's gonna fit balls into tight windows, and he's gonna make accurate throws. But you can game plan for that, as we saw in the earlier, you know, in the game that happened earlier. And so, obviously, UT is going to make adjustments, but how much is there to tweak that based off that first game? Georgia's going to make adjustments, too. And so, are they going to be able to make enough adjustments for it to matter based off of just, they went into Austin and just put a beat down on them.
Yeah.
So, that's also going to be in the back of everyone's mind. Sark, not, you know, Sark is whatever. I don't think Sark's a very good coach either.
I like his mentality, but I think his coaching abilities, you know, could use maybe a little bit of work. Remember that Texas is 0-1 against CFP top 25?
They lost in the CFP last year. Quite, wasn't a very pretty game. Well-coached game at all last year. Sark in big games will... We've yet to see. Again, they put up 17 points against a pretty poor A&M team.
Yeah. And, I mean, Red River every year.
Yep. I mean, they lost last year to Oklahoma.
Yeah. I was sitting right here when they lost to Oklahoma.
I mean,
right in the studio.
Yeah, Sark in big games. We've yet to really see.
I think this will be a really
It'll
big
be a good
testament.
Test, but I do think Georgia's going to pull it out. I think it could be an ugly one. Like, really, really
it
ugly
could be
one.
Really, really.
It could look a lot like that A&M-UT game did. So, we'll see, because both of these teams have, at times, just gone silent this year, so we'll see.
Maybe it's the lack of Bevo, because you told
Bevo
me that
won't
Bevo
be there.
Was not. Yeah,
Bevo will not
I
be
think,
there.
I think, guys, Bevo is banned from Atlanta.
Bevo is banned from, at least from Mercedes-Benz Stadium.
Yeah.
Personally, I think Texas is just going to pull out the win. The key to the Georgia win in the first match of the season, like in week 8, was that they jumped out to a 23-0 lead, and basically, no matter what Carson Beck did, like, he threw three interceptions, and, like, it really didn't matter in terms of the overall impact, like, the result of the game. So as long as Texas keeps it somewhat close in the beginning of the game, I think they just have a chance. Quinn Ewers threw, like, 43 times in that first matchup, and that's just really not sustainable, especially when he's prone to making some really questionable decisions at time, like we saw in the A&M game. I'd love to see them use Archie Manning a little bit more and run, run options, sort of just how they like, sort of a like a Lamar Jackson type player, and I think that sort of is just going to slow down the Georgia pass rush. And then just when we talk about just like motivations and just overall who needs this game, Georgia's already in the playoff, just based on because they already beat Texas and they already beat Tennessee, so they're going to be in the playoffs no matter what. And I just don't see a reason why they need to go out there and they need to compete against Texas. So they've already beaten them once this season, so there's really no motivation to go out there and beat this Longhorns team. And Texas, like, they want to have an opportunity at having that number one seed, because that looks like a very favorable, like, sort of line to the championship.
And a bye week, a first-round bye.
Yeah, so that's going to be big for this Texas team, especially when Quinn Ewers has sort of been dealing with an injury sort of throughout the season.
And talk about a lot more motivation being your very first year in the SEC, and you've powered through this whole thing with your one obstacle being Georgia.
Yeah, I mean, they're basically playing a road game in Atlanta. It's just going to be all Georgia fans.
Yeah.
So, like, Texas is going to have the motivation. They want to beat Georgia, who they've lost to.
There's a huge chip on the shoulder.
I would love to see how many of Georgia's neutral site games have been played in Atlanta over the last 20 years.
Isn't the SEC championship game always?
It's always in Atlanta, but then every other neutral site game that Georgia plays always seems to be in Atlanta. Like, I wonder what the last
Georgia game in Atlanta.
It was in Atlanta. Yeah. I wonder what the last true. To be fair to that one, it's like 2 hours away, 2.5 to 3 from both of them.
Yeah.
But what was the last true neutral site game that Georgia played? Because it
when they play Florida, is that a when they play in Jacksonville, is that a
yeah
neutral site? I don't know.
Yeah, but also it's Jacksonville, so it's not like a whole lot of Florida fans are going.
But anyway, Georgia has struggled with sort of motivation this season. I mean, we saw it in the Georgia Tech game where they just really just couldn't get going until late. And I think Texas is talented enough that if they get out to an early lead, there's just no – Georgia, I just don't think, has enough to sort of come back. I mean, we saw it in the Alabama game where, like, Georgia tried extremely hard to sort of come back in that second half and played probably one of the best halves of football I've ever watched, and yet it just wasn't good enough. And that Texas team is objectively better than this Alabama team.
The University of Georgia Bulldogs last played at a neutral site that was not in Georgia – in 1995 at the University of Florida's campus.
That's 30 years ago. That is insane.
Yes. So, there's your answer.
That's insane. That's 30 years ago.
It's 30 years. I don't know. But Georgia, you remember, also has, and probably has for the past years, has had the first-ranked recruiting class. They have one of the most powerful teams in the nation. And that's like hard to debate, and so there's so much, like, probably press and PR around this team that just has, like, money and can just get them to wherever they want to go. Regardless of that, the ACC Championship, number 12 Clemson and number 9 SMU at 8 p.m. Eastern Time will be in Charlotte, North Carolina. I am kind of really loving these neutral sites except for the one in Arlington. I just don't find that city very appealing. Anyways, another first time in history matchup, Clemson's Cade Klubnik. I hope he chooses to throw the ball over running it. This guy is really good with his arm. He's got a 64% completion rate, 5 interceptions on the year, likely to stay throughout the championship. And I do think that Clemson is one of those sneakily good teams that at the end of the day, the odds just lined up in their favor, and now they're going to the championship. SMU, on the other hand, another first year in the ACC, and they're in the championship. Do y'all see a theme here, or is it just me?
Yep, all four.
All four Power Four have a first-year team in their championship. So that's why I asked you that question, like, what do y'all think of realignment? I don't know, guys. I'm just using my big brain over here. So if this offense is ranked 6th nationally, Kevin Jennings, and a 66% completion rate, and Brashard Smith has 14 touchdowns on 1,157 yards. The Rush defense is 4th nationally, allowing 95 yards per game, a 72% stop rate, but sadly struggles when the ball is thrown. The defense has had 4 touchdowns total, coming off of 2 interceptions and 2 coming from fumbles. And for their debut year in the ACC, the Mustangs have been pretty dominant. They handled Pitt pretty well, handed Pitt their first loss of the season in week 9, also allowed Jennings to perform at his all-time best versus a number 22 Louisville in week 6 was that? I think it was week 5 or 6, but there you go. Thoughts?
I think I am very excited for this game. The big issue with this is that I would love to see Clemson win and get in. I think they've played well enough. I think they deserve it. The issue with that is knowing that the way the committee does things, it would probably push SMU out. It would definitely push Miami out. And so, you know, the ACC would get screwed over. And so that'd be pretty brutal. But I think this is going to be probably the most entertaining game of the weekend. Just purely aesthetic-wise, I think SMU is a very fun team to watch. I think Clemson is going to put up a ton of points. I think their defense is good, It just seems every time they play big games, like against Louisville, they just seem to give up way too many points. And it's like, what are you doing? And then they just lost last weekend again. When Clemson's played the games, you know, that they need to win, they haven't been able to win them this year. But they're a good team. They have a great defense. Dabo Sweeney has been there before. I think that'll help a lot. This SMU storyline is just so fun, though. It's so fun. First year in the ACC, you know, historically great college football program, finally seems to be returning, you know, to the national spotlight versus, you know, a Clemson team who's, you know, they believe they're one of the blue bloods now, and it's a very cool lot of storylines, very cool historical meaning, I guess, and it could be a very interesting indictment, we'll say, of the playoff committee based off the way this goes, who they decide to put in if SMU does lose. And, you know, when 7-9-3 SEC teams end up in the playoffs somehow, and everyone's like, well, this sucks. And then next year, the SEC just ends up with their own 12-team playoff, and they just play 17 games themselves. And it's, oh, we're just going to become the minor leagues for the NFL. We're going to play 17 games, and we'll crown our own champion. And, oh, we're the SEC. We're better than everyone else. But I think...
No bias there. Don't worry.
A three-loss team, unless you win your conference, has no business being anywhere near the playoff.
Truth.
You weren't good enough in the regular season. I don't care how talented you are. I don't know how I'm on this topic again. I talked about it earlier already. But that is just to say, I think the ACC deserves more than one team in. I don't think SMU should be punished for losing a game that they had to be dominant all year to even get into. They had to go 11-1 to get in. They did that. And then for them to be punished for losing this game, I think would be an absolute shame. With that said, I do think Clemson wins this game.
Take that to Twitter, please.
I can't get in any more Twitter arguments.
Yeah,
get my account banned.
Make the burner Twitter.
It's it's disheartening to see that, like, in all likelihood, if Clemson wins this game, SMU is out of the playoffs.
Conversation.
I mean, the committee has already set a precedent that record clearly doesn't matter to them, and they're just going to put in Alabama over a 11-2 or 10-2 Miami team who's been playing fantastic all season and is a joy to watch. So this is basically a must-win game for both teams. It's basically 50-50. You know, I think the spread is
two
to Clemson. But SMU has like a 54% chance of winning on ESPN. So it's going to be a great game. I'm excited to see it. I think it's going to be a high-scoring sort of shootout. And personally, I just think Clemson has the edge just because they've been here before, just particularly because Dabo Sweeney has been. Cade Klubnik has made questionable decisions before. We talk about the interception he threw at the very end of the South Carolina game. Clemson does make mistakes sometimes, but I think just SMU just hasn't been on this big stage before, and I just don't think they just have enough to sort of get over this final hurdle. And unfortunately, I think it's going to cost them a spot in the playoffs.
What a take. I hear you there. I do just want to say that I think that because this is their first year, they are going to play a little bit more harder because they know that this is a big win. Both teams know that. They both have this chip on their shoulder that without this win, they're out, which is really unfortunate. And if you won't take it to Twitter, I will.
Go ahead.
I will. Don't worry.
Just clip it and post on Twitter. Post the clip.
Fine.
Of me saying it, so I get credit for the take.
Oh, sure. Whatever. I'll do that. I saw that you did like my tweet earlier today.
I was a big fan of that. Unfortunately, you know, College Gridiron was not on my top Spotify podcast, but it should have been.
Fake.
It should have been.
I don't know. I just use Twitter so unseriously. I need help, basically. But who doesn't need help? The Big Ten Championship game, number one Oregon, number three Penn State at 8 p.m. Eastern. In Indiana, and first times teams meet since 94, Penn State won 38-20 over only four meetings. The Ducks have come out victorious once in 1964.
It's about to be twice. This Oregon team is.
I don't know. I think our producer Bradley Brine would say otherwise.
Hush, Bradley. Hush. he's got. We want to talk about bias. He's got bias Penn State takes.
He does have very bias. I think we all, there's always that little bit of bias in each one of these episodes.
No bias.
We say no bias, but there's always bias.
There's never any bias, especially not from this chair right here. This mic has never produced any bias, neither has this voice or this brain. But
this is going to be a game to watch. I remember us talking about Dylan Gabriel at the very beginning of the season. He was in the Heisman conversation, not really anywhere. That Heisman conversation has just changed drastically throughout the season. But he's sitting at number 10th for yards and 3rd for completion percentage, 73.5. And he will probably set a new record on Saturday with his 62nd career start.
Passing former Oregon quarterback Bo Nix.
Yes, exactly. But the Ducks.
Who's the next geriatric old man that Oregon's going to bring in?
I don't know. Great question.
Alan Bowman.
Maybe.
Who just got cleared for his 8th year. He was in the same recruiting class as Trevor Lawrence. Fun fact. But back to this game, because no one cares about Oklahoma State football.
Nobody. And nobody cares about 8th year. Wait, what year? Just out of, this is so random. Wait, how many years left of eligibility does Beck have? This is his final year. This is 6th? Or 5th?
No, he's I think technically he could get another year if he wanted. I believe he is a senior, though. No. True senior.
Okay.
I think.
He's a redshirt senior.
Redshirt senior, okay. So it is his 5th year.
Okay. But anyways, back to what's important here, because Carson Beck is not important at all. The Ducks rank 3rd in Big Ten scoring offenses, 15th total offense, and 2nd in pass offense. Now that's a lot. Just a lot. But don't worry, because they also ranked 5th in rushing offense. And they're looking for their first 13-0 start. Their first 13-0 season in their first year in this conference, but I would watch out for Oregon secondary if I were a PSU player, because it holds just 171 yards per game throughout the air. Now, on the Penn State side, Drew Aller ranks 5th in the country in yards per pass attempt with 9.36, which is also the 2nd in the Big Ten, and 5th in completion percentage with 71.6, 3rd nationally, and 7th in passing efficiency, 167.5. Penn State is 4-8 all time in regular season matchups where both teams were ranked in the top 5 in the AP poll, and the offense is 3rd in Big Ten red zone touchdown percentage, 12th nationally with 67.15, and in scoring offense, 34.26, and 4th in total offense, 423.44. That was a lot of numbers for no reason, but give me some words, because I hated those numbers.
I mean, this Oregon team is just really good. Like, you don't need it. You can list as many numbers as you want, but just looking and watching this Oregon team play, it's just incredible to watch. I mean, the only like slip up they've had is like maybe the Wisconsin game, but those games happen in the Big Ten.
Also,
so
maybe the Boise State game, but
yeah, but
early
in the season, you know, that those things happen. This Oregon team can give up chunk plays in the air, but I think that's really just because they're up by so many points that the opposing team basically just has to force these sort of chunk plays and try to get back into the game. And then Penn State just doesn't show up in big games. And we've talked about this with Franklin, but he just cannot, for whatever reason, beat a good team. I don't know how Penn State is ranked so high. They've beaten basically no one besides their regular Big Ten schedule. And
welcome to the Big Ten. That's yeah. How every Big Ten team seems to be.
Yeah, and I just don't understand why they're ranked so high. But Penn State just cannot win big games, and I don't see why that's going to change when they play at the best team in the country in the Oregon Ducks.
Yeah.
I would agree. I think this is probably one where
you can turn this one off and watch the ACC one.
Yeah.
They're at the same time. Like, you know what's going
to
happen
here. I think
Penn
State's a pretty fraudulent number 4. I think Oregon is, I mean, coast to coast, been the best team in the country without a doubt. They've been the number 1 team in the country since, I think, week 4, maybe. They are the number 1 team in the country. I think indisputable. You know, everyone behind them is lost stupid games or something stupid's happened, you know, or there's
They're
argument
the,
about who
the most
deserves,
consistent.
But Oregon, in a year where everything has been up in the air and everyone's talking about parity, Oregon has coast to coast been the best team. They've shown they deserve to be the best team. And I think it's going to be a game where there'll be a lot of hype, a lot of, oh, what if Penn State wins? What happens? Is Penn State the number one team in the country if they win? Yada, 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 yada. And then it'll come out and Penn State will lose by, 25. And it'll be like, well, welcome to the Big Ten. Everyone sucks. SEC needs 17 teams in.
This Penn State team just can't win big games. I've said this before. I mean, the only issue is, like, maybe Oregon has a lack of motivation going into this game, but, like...
because they know they're number one.
Yeah, and no matter what, they're going to host it. Maybe they play week five, and, like, maybe it'll just... they'll be the fifth seed, and they'll play a fairly easy, like, probably ASU team or something like that. And so they'll be in, and maybe they'll have a warm-up game for some of the more competitive games in the playoff. But, I mean, just... The only thing I see Oregon being sort of the downfall of this team is just not getting going early. And Penn State's defense is good. We'll give them that. So if they maybe force a couple turnovers and are up 17-0 going into the second quarter, then maybe there's an issue where Oregon loses.
Maybe. But those are the big games that you can or can't turn off. I think we're all in... like agreement here that the ACC is the better 8 p.m. primetime game to turn on. Sorry, Bradley, but that is just from the perspective of the on air. And so Heisman's will be announced Monday the 9th. Should we just go through 1, 2, 3? Do you want me to go 1, 2, 3 and then y'all go 1, 2, 3? Or do you want to go 1, 2, 3? I don't hear it is.
Okay. You go with your top three.
Give us the top three.
So my top three is Ashton Jeanty, Travis Hunter, and then surprisingly Cam Ward. And I feel like those top two are definitely the two front runners for this award. They've both broken records. They're both making statements. But Cam Ward, I see something in him that I feel like not a lot of people do. Like, this guy definitely can get the job done. He's one of the top quarterbacks in the nation. That's undisputable. Do I think he's deserving of the Heisman? To a degree. I think there are better players like Travis and Ashton, but if this were to go to a quarterback, it would have to go to Cam Ward.
Yeah, I mean, he's just been electric to watch this season. The only thing I would switch is I'd personally give it to Travis. I think I understand the argument that, just because he plays two sides of the ball doesn't automatically mean he's the best player in the country. But I think you do have to consider that. But he's also just one of the best receivers just in the country, period. And he's really good on defense. I think he's their number one corner. And this Colorado team has been competitive enough all season. They're still ranked. And there was a moment where they potentially could have made the playoffs. And just because of how relevant Colorado has been and how solid they've been throughout the season, I think you have to give it to Travis Hunter. I think maybe last season when Colorado was, 3-7?
I believe 4-8.
4-8. You just couldn't give it to him just because of how bad Colorado was. But I think they're good enough this year that you basically have to give it to the best player and the most exciting player to watch in this country.
Yeah.
I have the same top three as Isabella. And, you know, I hear what you're saying, but Travis Hunter isn't the best offensive player on his team. That's Shedeur Sanders. I think there's an argument to be made that he's not the best receiver on his team. I think that's LeJonte Wester. Is he the best cornerback on their team? Yes. But you don't give Heismans to cornerbacks. Cornerbacks don't win Heismans. Like, that hasn't been a thing, right? So then... is being an above-average receiver along with a very good cornerback enough to win a Heisman? I don't know. I don't think Travis Hunter is a top...
I think he's favored right now.
He is favored by a lot, but I don't think Travis Hunter is a top 20 receiver in the country. I don't think he's a top 10 cornerback in the country. And so... just putting, the number 25 receiver and the number 12 cornerback in the country together add up to the most impactful player in the country. Maybe. Is he the best player in the country? I don't think so. Is he the most valuable player in the country? Definitely not. That is 150,000% Ashton Gentry. If you take Ashton Gentry off of that Boise State team, they're not even sniffing the playoff. If you take Travis Hunter off of that Colorado offense, they still have very good receivers and they have an elite quarterback. If you take him off of that Colorado defense, the defense still sucks. Like, the defense isn't good. It wasn't good with him. It'll be slightly worse without him, but, you know, whatever. It is what it is. If you take him off that team completely, maybe instead of going 9-3, they go 7-5, 8-4. But I think the best player in the country is no one of these three. I think the best player in the country is Caleb Downs. I think the most talented player in the country is Caleb Downs. I think the most impactful, best season goes to Ashton Gentry. Most valuable and best season goes to Ashton Gentry. I will say I think Travis Hunter is the most impactful player because he affects the game so much on both sides of the ball. How much of that is a concerted effort on offense to, you know, force him the ball because Shedeur Sanders throws the ball 50 times a game?
Do they not force it to Ashton?
I mean, if you look, Gentry, you know, didn't play the second half of a couple games.
Yeah, because they're playing Hawaii. Like, they're playing cupcake teams, basically.
Yeah, but he only played a half. He played one half. So, like, he had, I think, 145 yards against, whatever team they played in week three. But he played a half and had 13 carries. He had 13 carries on 145 yards. Like, and then for the first half of the season, he was averaging, like, 11 yards per carry before team started playing eight-man boxes against him, right? And he's still, he's getting more carries as the season goes on because of just the way it is. He's still averaging 7.8 yards per carry. Like, he still, people want to, you know, compare it to that Barry Sanders record that, you know, he's, I think, 397 yards or 367 yards away from at this point. People are saying he's played more games, though. Barry did it in 11. He still has less carries than Barry Sanders had in that season. So, like, it's not like he's getting some insane amount of carries like that we've never seen before, like unprecedented amount of carries. He's getting a pretty normal amount of touches for an elite running back on a non-Power 5 team, right? Like, it's a group of five teams, so obviously the talent isn't going to be as high, so your best player is going to get more touches, but he's still not getting like historical off the chart amounts of touches. Like, he's putting up crazy insane numbers inside of a reasonable amount of carries. He's averaging, I think, 26 carries a game, which is not anywhere close to unheard of. I think that's pretty similar to what Derrick Henry got when he won the Heisman. So,
okay. I mean, that's fair. That's fair.
That's just my thought process behind it.
You could give it to either of them, and you can't really complain. So.
Yeah. No, I think all of our top two options are, like, the front runners, obviously. They're both pretty impactful players on both of their teams, respectively. I'm excited for Monday. Let's see what this has to offer. And with that, that will be all from us. Big thank you to Thomas, Barrett, and especially Bradley for listening to our takes. And College Gridiron is a production of none other than WFUV Sports.